This is Andy Zodin with KickServeRadio.com, and I am joined by Steve Flink, author of The Greatest Tennis Matches of All Time. And Steve, I want to talk to you about your trip to Australia, because I know it was absolutely amazing. But first things first, a lot of things that people like to hear about when we talk concern American tennis. We started out the year and we saw Jack Sock come out of the gates fast, doing really well in Auckland, getting wins over Kevin Anderson and David Ferrer. But really lately, it's been all about Taylor Fritz, making it to the finals in Memphis, losing a tough one to Kei Nishikori, but playing some great tennis along the way. They're now calling Taylor Fritz America's greatest hope for success out on the ATP Tour. Do you agree?
I do agree. I just hope that doesn't become an impediment. I hope that, you know, that doesn't add to the burden. He already knew that a lot was expected of him. However, I think he carries himself in such a way where I believe that he has a tremendous belief in himself, and he has the game. He's got, of course, the makings of one of the great first serves. He needs to improve his second slightly, but I like the way he looks off the ground. He's got so many things going for him, Andy. Plus, he's a good match player, and he's a good competitor. And in the semifinals there, on his way to the final against Nishikori, he had Benjamin Becker serve for the match against him. He broke back and won that one. He had a lot of really good, hard-fought wins. And then against Nishikori, he was up 3-love in the first set. So it was a good effort in a straight-set loss, and he showed he wasn't intimidated by a top-10 player.
You hear about Francis Tiafoe, you hear about Stefan Kozlov, Tommy Paul, Riley Opelka, Taylor Fritz. There's so many young American players that I know Martin Blackman is excited about as the new director of player development with USTA. When you were in Australia, did you sense this heightened sense of promise with the young American players?
There was a fair amount of talk about it among those that follow American tennis closely, absolutely. Now, of course, this was the first major of the year. It was in Australia. There wasn't as much being said there as I'm hearing about since I returned. But I do think this wave of players that you just mentioned is the most impressive group we've had in a long, long time. And I do think Jack Sock, if he can avoid some of these injuries and setbacks, you know, he could make a move close to the top 10 this year. And Taylor, just on the outskirts of the top 100, and who knows where he's going, but I think that this is going to be a really important developmental year for him. So I'm pretty excited about it, as I can tell you are. And I think we'll know a lot more 6 months from now.
Yeah, great point about Taylor Fritz. Jumps maybe, 1,000 spots in a little bit under a year. Pretty good jump.
It sure is. And then not by accident, hard work, winning a bunch of challengers, but then to jump out in a tournament like Memphis, you know, where you're in the big leagues now and dealing with different, harder, tougher fields, and to do what he did there in a breakthrough event, that was phenomenal.
You went down to Australia, Steve. You were very impressed with the venue. A lot of people have the Australian Open as something that they absolutely have on their bucket list. Talk about why it should be there.
It's funny, Andy. Here I am, you know, I've missed 3 Wimbledon since 65, and I've only missed 1 U.S. in that period, and every French since 82, but I'd never been to the Australian, and I thought it was time I had to get there. And I'd heard great things about it, but it exceeded my expectations, because I think the layout and the size of the show courts is so ideal. You got that Rod Laver Arena with 15,000 seats, and when that roof is open, it's an idyllic atmosphere. And then you could walk next door to Margaret Court Arena if it's raining, and not even have to step outside. And you have Margaret Court Arena and Hisense at 10,000 and 7,500 seats respectively. They're just sized perfectly, and the layout of the place, it lives up to that label of the friendly slam, the happy slam. It's more relaxed than the other majors, and yet you know how much it still means to all the players. I didn't expect it to be quite as spectacular as it was as a venue. I knew as an event it was well run, but I didn't know the venue was going to be that impressive.
Not surprising that Novak Djokovic would win there for the, 5th or 6th time now, beating Andy Murray in the final. What was surprising was what happened on the women's side. Angelique Kerber is able to take down Serena Williams in a tough slugfest of a 3-setter. Do you think Kerber's going to be somebody that Serena needs to worry about for the rest of the year, or do you think that maybe was a little bit of a fluky result?
I don't think it was a fluky result, Andy. I think that she'll have to worry about her, but I mean, I still think obviously day in, day out, she's a better player. She's going to beat her at least 2 out of 3 times, but she knows that Kerber is not the kind of player she wants to meet when she's not quite feeling up to snuff. I mean, years ago when she lost to her on hard courts on the road to the U.S. Open, I remember thinking, wow, Kerber, you know, if she catches her at the right time, she's dangerous because she's a left-hander and she's so industrious and such a great a defensive player. She can run down so many balls, and then she's a good tactician as well. And What I loved about this match was she won the first set, and then Serena seemed to find her range and took the second, and you figured Serena was on her way to victory. And then in the third, Kerber, you know, opened up that 5-2 lead, and Serena came back at her again and even had a game point for 5-all. That's what impressed me. I thought Serena played quite well in the last two sets, but Kerber was up to the task because she had a game plan, and she stuck to it assiduously.
I think it should be noted, Steve, that Kerber has been working with the great Gil Reyes for the last couple of years, and it just seems like Gil is able to instill both a warrior mentality and physicality into his players. Certainly, we saw that with Andre Agassi. Now we're seeing it with Kerber, and that seems to have caught the attention of Martin Blackman, who now is trying to recruit Gil Reyes to take a greater role with the USTA Player Development Department. Do you think that's a good call for USTA to have Gil Reyes involved?
You wonder, Andy, why it didn't happen sooner, but it's definitely would be very wise, and his track record is so demonstrable. I mean, there's no question that he could help a lot of young players, and I think the case you cite with Kerber is a very good one, and I'm sure he's played a significant role in her rise here, and I just hope she can live up to that label of number two in the world and contend for more majors because she's good for the game. And you could see, by the way, that Serena, how much she respected her with the way she reacted after that defeat, as gracious as she's ever been. But to get back to Gil, absolutely, the sooner the USTA moves in his direction, the better.
Steve, as far as Novak Djokovic goes, is there any reason to think that that guy, after winning in Australia, can't match the results of 2015 in 2016, including potentially going down to Rio and adding Olympic gold?
No, there isn't. I mean, you look at the other top players. I mean, yes, there's Stan Wawrinka on a given day, as he did at Roland Garros in the finals a year ago, and as he did once before the Australian Open. Sure, he's going to have those occasional days, but I think they're going to be rare. And I think that Novak at this point pretty much owns Nadal, and he's better than Federer. Roger did win three times against him out of eight last year, but then he opens the year, Novak does, by beating Roger emphatically in four sets in Australia. So if you look around the landscape, the other top players, you got to feel that Novak has got a clear-cut edge over all of them. And so for the immediate future, why shouldn't he be able to rake in a lot more majors? And it's, you got to believe, Andy, I don't know if you agree with me, that this must be the year for Roland Garros. Three finals in the last 4 years, losing to Wawrinka a year ago and Nadal the year before that. He's had some hard luck in Paris, but he's clearly as good on clay, in my view, as he is on any other surface. And he's just overdue, I think, to win the French. And then who knows? Who's to say he shouldn't defend Wimbledon and defend the U.S. Open? And as you say, the Olympics is right in the mix there in the summer, and he'll go after that one. I do expect him to win at least two more Grand Slam titles this year, plus probably the Olympics as well.
I absolutely agree with you, Steve, with respect to this being the year for him at Roland Garros. If not, you would suspect it's only because he's allowed the situation to continue to get into his own head. He seems to sometimes maybe be his own worst enemy from the perspective of he wants this so badly that maybe he adds just an extra little bit of pressure onto himself that maybe prevents him from finally getting over and winning that title.
Yeah, it could well be. I think it's also, Andy, it's true in the younger years. I definitely think he was too emotional for his own good and maybe too, he's become unhinged a little bit like he did against Nadal for a while in the 2012 final and it stages in 2014. But I do think he's moved past that. And I thought last year had more to do with some type of a lingering leg injury that you could see him shaking that leg out throughout the tournament, and he took an 8-minute injury timeout against Murray in the semifinals. Something was a little off there for him that was making life more difficult for him a year ago. I think emotionally right now, he's as stable as he's ever been, and that I think that should help him finally get over the hump and win at Roland Garros.
Before Roland Garros, first things first, though, Steve, the upcoming American Hardcourt Tour, specifically Indian Wells, followed by Miami. What are the things that we need to look for?
Well, I think for one thing, we want to see can he take that talent of his and that drive and that competitive spirit out onto the hard courts here into these bigger events? That was an important step in a tournament like Memphis. Can he do it in a Masters 1000? And really make his presence known. I think it's going to be fun for the American fans who saw Kerber topple Serena Williams in Melbourne to see if she can make a big impression at one or both of those big hardcourt events in Indian Wells and Miami. Those are certainly a couple of the primary storylines as I see it. And I think then we'll probably be looking to see whether it's going to be an interesting test to see in that phase, does Nadal Is he finally ready to make a serious move back? I thought he was going to be number two in the world this year, Andy, before the year started. And, of course, he's off to a very rocky start. But that phase is going to tell us a lot about where his confidence is, because in his better years, you know, he's won Indian Wells a bunch of times, and he's done really well, a whole bunch of finals in Miami as well. And if Rafa can do something like that this year, a win in a final or a couple of finals or something along those lines, then we'll know. But if it's more of the same and we have more losses like Verdasco in Australia or Verdasco in Miami last year, it may be a sign that even when he gets back out under the clay that Rafa is really struggling.
He's the great Steve Flink, author of The Greatest Tennis Matches of All Time. Steve, thanks for taking the time today, and glad you enjoyed your stay down in Australia.
Andy, thanks for having me on. Look forward to being with you again in the near future.